You are listening to The Christian Commute, a commute-length podcast about Christian apologetics, theology, and other matters of Christian interest. Here is your host, Seth Dunn.
It is Thursday, May 19th. This is The Christian Commute. I am your host, Seth Dunn, and you're riding home with me for the second show of three this week, Lord willing. Got back in the saddle, what was it, Tuesday, yep. And Thursday and Friday are my other work from home days. So here we go. And the company, let me tell you, they got their money's worth out of me today. I'm only leaving because somebody else turned out the lights. And I looked down and was like, oh goodness, it's 5:15. And then I sat there and I said to myself, I'm really making some good progress. I don't want to get up and leave. So I worked a few minutes longer and then left. The best work days are the work days where you don't feel like you're working and the time just flies by because you're doing something interesting. And I was doing something very interesting to me. And that, woo, got to get up across the road. That is making queries and spreadsheets in the SQL server. I love that. That's what I really liked about my old job, and that's what I was brought into this job to do, and I had a great day today. By the way, when I get into the office, I'm usually the first one there. I know if anybody from my old office is listening, they're shocked, but since I'm going further, I have to get up early to get here on time. And that puts me here before anyone else. In the office, the people on the plant floor, they're already there. But in the office, I walk in. Every day, the lights are off. I don't turn them on. Because if nobody else came, I wouldn't turn the lights on. And somebody will turn them on. And today, somebody turned them off. So I was like, I guess it's time to go home. But when you work really far away from your house, you have to be disciplined about getting up at the same time every day to get there at your work time, because there could be traffic or something like that. Plus, I'm new here. At the old place, I'd work there 8 years and be like, I'm going to get up when I want to get up. Maybe I'll come to work today. I might just say I'm tired and sleep late and then say, oh, I'm working from home. And for whatever reason, I decide that I'm going to do. And what are you going to say about it? Nothing. So that was a nice thing about where I did work, is I'm going to get there when I want to get there. I'm going to leave when I want to leave. And maybe I won't even go. But, you know, I'm new here. I got to prove myself. So I'm going to show up. Now the new bosses are like listening to this thing. Oh my gosh, this guy 5 years from now, he's going to stop coming to work. As long as you get the job done, listen to me, people, especially in today's COVID, post-COVID work-from-home world. And I've always had this opinion. If you're salaried, as long as you get the job done, I don't care where you are or when you arrive or when you leave. Just get the job done, and if there's a meeting, don't miss it. Just like, don't miss the Christian Commute and the full show I have for you today. So I broke the streak of questions Monday, and the tragedy is I didn't have to. I had a question from Jeff from Slow Driving Florida that he had called in, and I forgot to star it in my inbox. But I'm going to answer it today, and then I'm going to be out, and then Friday I'm going to be out of questions unless you guys get on the ball to sending your questions in. But it is a full show today because I'm going to take that topic. We're continuing in our series of awful abortion arguments. This one's going to be various biblical misapplications of the issue from non-believers. And you guys know I don't like to get into the body of the show topic, the details of the show topic before it starts. But just think of things like this. Do you ever have unbelievers arguing with you about the Bible? It's like, the Bible means this. It's like, You don't even believe it. This is my religion. Don't tell me what the Bible means. Like, I've been going to church since I was a little kid. I've been reading the Bible since I knew how to read. Don't tell me what you think the Bible means. And, like, what the rest of us think it means. Like, yeah, I can have it wrong. I'm just one person. But what do you think non-Christian, non-believer, skeptical, atheist, liberal Democrat person who wants to abort babies, what do you think that our entire church and all the other churches got together? Not just mine, but all the Baptists got together, all the Presbyterians and the Methodists. I'm not talking about mainline denominations. I'm talking about evangelical denominations. And you could even throw in the Catholics. And then the Catholics and the Orthodox. And we all got together and read the Bible for 2,000 years. And we came up with this pro-life position that's been fairly stable throughout history. But you, non-believer who picked up the internet, I was about to say picked up the Bible, that you read the on the internet later, or yesterday, some arguments about how the Bible is not pro-life. You're going to tell me what my religion means. Stop it. Now, there's no argument there. You notice there's no argument there? It's just, stop being ridiculous. That would be like me going up to a Muslim and being like, well, you can eat pork on Tuesday. I know you're not supposed to eat pork and drink alcohol, but I read on the internet where you can eat pork on Tuesday because of Muhammad did it or something. You know, I'm just making something up. I mean, I don't know. And like, I've never read the Quran, and I'm going to tell you that. And you live your whole life by it. Now, you'll have to forgive me for the false equivalency, because the Quran is the devil's scriptures. And it's not true like the Bible. But you see that principle? It's like, how full of yourself do you have? Do you think we're just so stupid that we can't figure out our own book? All right. So that's going to be my attitude when I'm addressing some of these issues. Burning down the straw man I set up. How about that? But, oh, hey, as always, let's get to the Bible chapter review. I like to do the Bible chapter review on the freeway, so I talked a long time so I could get here. We're starting a new chapter today, finally. We're going to Matthew chapter 12. And I'm stuck. I'm stuck in very congested, unusually congested traffic on I-75. And there's one reason for this. And it's this tractor trailer up here in the left lane where he doesn't belong, backing everybody else up. And nobody in the middle lane can get over, and everybody in the left lane is having to go too slow. And I'm driving this terrible Kia Soul. I'm not an aggressive driver in the Soul. I don't have the size or horsepower. But I will get over. Sorry to cut you off. You know who I cut off when I got over? Not in a rude way, but probably in a way where he had to slow down. It was a Kia Soul. What's he going to do about it in his little Kia Soul? The same thing. I would do nothing. Oh, my gosh. People are stopping. People are swerving. What is happening? I can't see above me. There was almost an accident. I don't know what happened. And now you guys are 8 minutes into the show, and there's been no Bible. Is there? What's going on? Holy smokes, there's traffic. I got to Google map my way out of here. Give me a second. All right, I don't have to Google map to a different direction. I'm going to stay on 75. Apparently, there's some debris in the road. I can smell burnt rubber, so I'm just going to have to get around it. This is what I get for putting in a good day's work, getting stuck in this traffic. And now I see what's up ahead. All right, well, I'm at a point where I feel comfortable doing the Bible show. Oh, sirens. Police car. Is that an ambulance or fire truck getting off the road? Rubberneckers. What a disaster. Let's get some Bible to you people. You deserve it. Have I talked about nothing for 9 minutes? Good grief. All right. Matthew chapter 12, starting a new chapter, verses 1 and 2. So Jesus says at the end of Matthew chapter 11, we reviewed it Monday, my burden is easy, my yoke is light. Or is it my yoke? It's my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Excuse me.
There's a slowdown ahead.
My yoke is easy and my burden is light. And that's the transition from chapter 11 to 12. And the text continues, Matthew continues. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. But when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, look, your disciples do what is not lawful on the Sabbath. So Jesus and his disciples are walking from one place to another. I don't know. I don't know if it's summer or winter. I don't know if they're hot or whatever. I don't know what time of day it is. But they're walking through the grain fields, and they're hungry, so they start picking some of the heads of the grain off and eating it. I don't suppose this is stealing. It just fields out in the public, I guess, and people are allowed to pick from them. So the closest thing I can think of to make a modern, make this analogous to modern times, because all Baptist preachers must make things analogous to modern times. We just must. Is if anybody's ever gone to do the literally godforsaken, you pick apples or you pick cherries or whatever they are suckering you into picking, agro-tourism. Why do I say godforsaken? Godforsaken. Because hard farm work is a result of the fall. Now we get things by the sweat of our brow. It didn't used to be hard to get food off trees. So that's why I call it godforsaken. I'm not just, you know, using a term. And I've talked about this before, how I hate it. My wife loves it. They get a bunch of women, they think it's cute, and they drag their families and their kids there, and I'm going to go out into the hot fields and fill up apples, a bag full of apples, and I'm going to pay extra to do it when I could have just walked into the orchard store and bought the basket or the bushel or half a bushel or whatever it is at apples right here. I live in apple country. I'm right by LJ, not far. But what you're allowed to do out there while you're filling your bag of apples, you can just take apples off the tree and eat them. Nobody cares. Now, granted, the disciples would not have been doing such farm labor on the Sabbath. So they're not eating as they gather. They're just walking around. So you can imagine, because listen, what am I doing? I'm driving on the concrete freeway from place to place. But back in the day when people walked, they'd get hungry from walking, and they're in an agrarian society, there's just food everywhere. So, oh, I'm hungry. Let me grab an apple off this tree. A road apple. The proverbial road apple. You're walking along the road. It's lined with trees on either way, on either side. Providing you shade, you get hungry, you've been walking all day, you pluck a road apple. You don't have to do any work for it. Road apple, boom, eating it. That's what they're doing. They're walking around through the grain fields, maybe it's a shortcut, I don't know. And they're a little hungry, so let me have a little snack. And as they're walking, they're picking the heads off the grain and they're eating it. So, you're not allowed to work on the Sabbath. That's not a Pharisee rule. That's a Bible rule. That's not one of these rules the Pharisees have put on people. It's really clear. You read in the Old Testament. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. That's the Ten Commandments. And then there's a whole explanation of how to do that. Don't work on the Sabbath. And there are people, it's their job to harvest wheat. If you're an apple picker, your job is to walk through those fields and pick apples. Because some of us are suckers and we'll pay to do it, but most people know they don't want to do that, so they have to pay somebody else to do that kind of work. Here's an example. Peter, James, and John, they're fishermen, right? What if they had got on their industrial fishing boat, not the John boat they bought at Academy Sports that they keep on the dock of the lake that they go out there to relax? What if they'd got on their industrial fishing boat, and that's what they had, industrial fishing boats with nets, and went on Sunday to catch fish? They would have been doing their job on the Sabbath day. That's wrong. They're not resting. What if they'd have been on the shore, I don't know, with a fishing pole, just hanging out after synagogue fishing? Is that work? No. I don't know if they had fishing poles back there. I'm making a difference. But do you see the juxtaposition here? These guys aren't working. They're not laboring. They're just hungry. They're just snacking because they're walking around. And the Pharisees are, look, your disciples, Jesus. They're doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath, because it's not lawful to pick crops. And by the way, in the Pharisees' minds, they've decided how far you can go before it's considered travel. Because you're not supposed to travel on the Sabbath either. So what can you do? Can you walk to the drugstore? Can you walk to the grocery store? I know they didn't have drugstores and grocery stores. And we do, and we drive. But how far can you walk? Can you go to your brother-in-law's house and hang out with him on the Sabbath if he's 3 doors down, if he's 10 doors down? They have rules for this. I'm not kidding. So here's what's going on. The disciples are not only picking the grains, but they're walking, they're traveling. And the Pharisees see this, and they come to Jesus. Look, your disciples are do what is not lawful on the Sabbath. They're condemning Jesus' disciples. Now here, don't miss it. To whom are Jesus' disciples yoked for the purpose of learning? Thinking about what Jesus said in the end of chapter 11. They're yoked to Jesus. And these Pharisees, the Pharisees have disciples too. They're yoked to them. And the people, to some degree, are yoked to the teaching of the Pharisees. The general people, whoever the people are, just regular everyday folk. I'd call them pew sitters nowadays. And here is the huge contrast. Jesus' disciples are hungry. The Pharisees' disciples would have walked around hungry, miserable, surrounded by food. Not Jesus' disciples, because his burden is easy. I'm sorry, his burden is light and his yoke is easy. He's not putting extra laws on people. He's not nullifying the law either. Lord willing, tomorrow on the Bible Chapter Review, we'll cover Jesus' response. I'm not going to go over the response right now. I'm going to milk 2 whole shows out of it. But I'm saying what this sets up for you right here, reader, is the yoke of the Pharisees versus the yoke of Jesus and what the difference is. You can eat when you're hungry, no matter what day it is, or you can be miserable because somebody says it's work to pluck a little head off of a stalk of grain. So with that, we're going to end the Bible chapter review and move on to the questions. And this, for real, is the last one. Do you have a question about Christian theology or apologetics? Does anybody listen to this show anymore? That's what happens when you don't give the people a new episode every day. They change the channel. If you have a question about Christian theology or apologetics, you can write to SethDunn88@gmail.com. SethDunn88@gmail.com. Or you can dial, just like Jeff did, 470-315-0875. Ooh, there's an advertisement right here at exit 312 for Panda Express. I'm not going to get it, but I could. What a wonderful country I live in. I lost my thyroid medicine weeks ago. I haven't found it yet. I guess I need to go get another prescription. So I've been hungry because I haven't been taking my medicine. Everything looks delicious. All right. Jeff's question. From Slow Driving Florida. Seth, in your opinion, what would it take to reform the Southern Baptist Convention and completely come back to the glory days of the past? And by glory days of the past, he's not referring to the conservative resurgence. I think he's referring to its founding. And here's the thing. Jeff shares my opinion that the Southern Baptist Convention is irredeemable. Jordan Hall called me this week and he said, do you want to go to the convention? He had asked me earlier and I said, yes, I would go. And he called me this week. He said, do you want to go? And I said, no, I just got a new job. I don't want to go out there. So the Southern Baptist Convention's happening in a couple weeks in June. I could have gone to vote for Tom Askell and get on the mic and talk about how horrible Al Mohler and Russell Moore are, even though Russell Moore is gone. But it's in Anaheim, and I said to myself, why do I want to take vacation days and then spend, I don't know, $2,000 to fly to California, and take vacation and get a hotel room and a motel room and rent a car and spend time away from my family to go to the Southern Baptist Convention for 2 days. And even if Tom Askell wins, which I don't think he will, I will have not righted the ship or taken the ship or whatever needs to happen to the ship. If it was in Atlanta or Nashville, I probably would have went. And then yesterday, I ate lunch with a friend of mine who's a local pastor, and he said, are you going to the convention? And I said, no. And I told him just what I told you. Jordan asked me if I wanted to go, but I'm not going to. And then he said, well, I'm not going to go either because I looked it up, and it's just too expensive. It's not worth it. And I was about to say to him, I said, I don't know why they don't have it in Atlanta every year. I said, they have Dragon Con every year in Atlanta on Memorial Day weekend at the same place. They have the Chick-fil-A Bowl, the Chick-fil-A College Cook-Off Memorial Day weekend in Atlanta every year. And all the same people come every year. I don't know why they don't do that. And then I stopped myself and said, yes, I know. I do know why. Because Dave Miller and all his friends want to take their vacations to new places every year. All these pastors that go from the churches that do go, the churches with big travel budgets to send these people, they want to go eat at the Cheesecake Factory in a different town. And then they want to fly their family there, or maybe they can get their wife signed up as a messenger and take a little mini vacation that they don't have to pay for. Anybody ever done that? I've been to John Calvin's house. I went to John Calvin's house. I told you all about it a couple years ago. Do you know who paid for that? Field Turf. Because I had to go to France and Germany, mind you. Oh, you know where else I went? I went to Worms in Germany, where they had the Diet of Worms, and I got my picture taken next to the Martin Luther statue because I wanted to go to a place where they had Reformation history. That town's full of Muslims now, by the way. I went there. You know who paid for that? Field Turf. You know why? Because I had to go to France, where our tufting plant was, to make the sports fields. And then I also had to go to Germany to our extrusion plant. And I said, well, I got a free ticket to France, and I've got to drive from Paris to the middle of nowhere where the tufting plant is. Oh, look, John Calvin's house is only 45 minutes out of the way. I'm going to go. Now, I paid my own, you know, $10 admission fee or whatever it was. But free travel on the company. One of my corporate goon friends does that all the time. She works with me, or worked with me, I should say, in the finance department there. And she's a single, successful woman. Nothing's tied her down. So she has money and time to travel. So whenever the company flies her to Paris, she'll take a week off and she'll just go be a tourist in Paris. That's what Southern Baptist Convention is. It's not people going to the business meeting to do business. It's a bunch of people taking mini vacations and going to little conferences. It's an event.
Head southeast on I-75 South.
And that's one of the reasons why it's so irredeemable. I don't think it would be as bad if we just had small business meetings, just basic business meetings that everybody would go to. Everybody, as in all the people in the South, even small church pastors, in Atlanta, or Nashville, or Louisville, where the seminary is, or even New Orleans. New Orleans is a little far south, but even New Orleans. Birmingham. You know, places where Southerners are, and Southern Baptists. But Jeff is saying, what would it take to reform it and get back to the glory days? I'd say the reset button. Now, hold on, Jeff, before we start talking about glory days of the Southern Baptist Convention. Let's keep in mind that it was founded by people who wanted to keep their slaves. So there was the Triannual Convention, or what's become known as the Northern Convention. The Southerners split away because the Northerners didn't want to convene to do missions with slaveholders. And I'm not going to get into theological justifications or lack thereof for slavery. But it's not like things were super great then. But I'll say this. Here was the mission. One sacred effort to put foreign missionaries on the mission field. And also, I guess at the time it would have been considered like a foreign missionary, to put missionaries to Indians on the home mission board field. What would it take to get back to that? To stop doing all the other crap? ERLC, NAM church planning, all the junk the seminaries get into with liberalism, conferences and conference, muckety-muck, muckety-muck, speakers. The problem with the Southern Baptist Convention is there's money to be made outside of going to die in a foreign land. Here's how the funding of the Southern Baptist Convention should work. We have identified an individual who is willing to go die and take his coffin with him to some godless pagan land halfway across the world. And he's willing to do it for $40,000 a year. He's not going to make a fortune for himself. He's not going to get paid a bonus. He's going to get paid basically a living wage and not much more to go and tell foreign people about Jesus in the hopes that they'll get saved. That's why the Southern Baptist Convention exists. And because pastoral education is a needed thing. People will disagree with me about seminary and how seminary is not mission. Missionaries are biblical. That's an apostle with a little A. It's just somebody who's sent to share the gospel. Little A apostle, to use our Southern Baptist Christianese. Seminary's not there. But the fact of the matter is, we're 2,000 years removed, at least, from the latest biblical book. And there's a lot of literary and historical context that needs to be understood that we don't understand because we have a cultural distance. Culture and time. And that's what you learn in seminary. In theory, what you learn in seminary is supposed to be, this is how to teach other people the Bible. This is how to put the biblical story in context for others. I try to do that for you guys on this podcast. I try to use my seminary training to do that. I use a New Testament. Whenever I switch to a new book, I've got a New Testament textbook, a seminary type textbook, and I go and I'm like, all right, when was the book written? What was the context? What was going on? Who's the immediate audience? If I don't remember, or to confirm my memory, I'll go do that. That's good. But what seminary has become is a bunch of guys who are trying to make a career for themselves and ladder jump. Remember when I used to tell you guys, I love my job at Field Turf. But if another company came along and said, Seth, we'll give you thousands of more dollars to do similar work, I would leave. And then I did that. I did that a month ago. Everybody, why would I not? It would be stupid not to do that for my family. What do I have to do? Drive 15 minutes further 3 days a week, and you're going to give me a whole lot more money? Like a Kia, not, you know, they didn't back up the Brinks truck, but they backed up I could fit all that money in the Kia Soul. I mean, my gosh, it was a lot. Yeah, bye. Bye, Field Turf. I mean, I had my frustrations with there, like you would after working somewhere for 8 years. But you're going to have that anywhere. See you, big race.
Head south on I-75 south.
Guys, I wore a Field Turf shirt, like a polo shirt, a Field Turf polo shirt to work every day. And for 7 years, I might have missed less than 20 days. Because sometimes I'd say, oh, it's spring, I'm going to wear pastels all this week. And then I would declare, oh, this is prep week. And just to be preppy, I'd wear all my alligator shirts. I'm wearing an alligator shirt today. It's been a while. I fill it out a little more than when I first got it. Let me tell you this. I don't know if I've talked about this before. I have something like 14 or 15 Field Turf shirts, 7 Field Turf jackets, Field Turf hats, Field Turf toboggans. All my clothes are Field Turf. I was an institution there in my little office. Ask Seth, he'll know. Hey guys, I'm gone. They gave me more money. Bye. Why? You know why? Because it wasn't my spiritual calling to shepherd them. I'm an accountant. I can do debits and credits anywhere off of anything. And if I work at this place for 8 years, and somebody comes along and offers me the kind of increase I got, I'll probably leave. But here's the thing. I'm not pretending that I was called. God has called me to be the plant controller of this factory and to tell you how many square feet per man hour you're working. Called to do it. The Lord's really leading me to tell you people what to do. No, that's what pastors say. Your church is something different. We call it a church family for a reason. You don't leave that church unless you leave town. But what do pastors do? They do level jumping from youth pastor to associate pastor to senior pastor. And now they go to seminary not for the purpose of being able to equip the saints, but being able to get the next big job. That's what a demon is. That's the difference. One thing we need to get rid of if we want to reform the convention, Jeff, is to get rid of the demon programs. Because the seminaries exist to make money and draw people in. Now the purpose of a seminary is to draw somebody in to the convention. It's a point of contact. Get rid of the demons. I get that seminary's not in the Bible. Fine, we can still get a PhD, a THM, an MA. Even my own MDiv is a professional degree. I don't really like... I hate the management part of it. This is how you do personnel management. This is how you do this. This is how you cast the vision. Forget you, I don't want to cast the vision. A woman, Erin Harding, just graduated from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary with a pastoral ministry degree. And the president said, well, you know, we don't believe in women pastors, but we're not going to encourage any church to hire her or hire, you know, but we'll get her in the degree program. Yeah, you'll take their money. You wicked. Danny Aiken's wicked. Listen, I'm convinced the people who run the Southern Baptist Convention are wicked men. I don't even know if they're saved. They're wicked. They're wicked, double-minded men. And do you know what's attracted them? Not spirituality, money and opportunity. The way to fix any denomination that's still theologically conservative, nominally, is to take the money away. If all the Southern Baptist Convention offered was training in theology, not training on vision casting, training in theology on how to teach the Bible to a congregation. I'm talking hermeneutics, homiletics, that's it. Greek, Hebrew, church history, Bible history, hermeneutics, homiletics. That's it. Systematic theology. If that's all the seminaries did, and they did it only for people who believed what, you know, the official denominational doctrine, if you don't believe the official doctrine, go somewhere else. There would be very little money in that. By the way, those professors don't make much, even now. No one would aspire to be some muckety-buck. Nobody, if the denominational graduates didn't care or aspire to be the president of XYZ Seminary, if people didn't care who Al Mohler and Danny Aiken were, if they're like, who? Like, when I went to UGA, I think the president's name was Mike Adams. Who cares? It's not about him, but now, oh, yeah, I'm going to get this is Al Mohler Seminary. Jamie Dew is the president of New Orleans Public. Who cares? And then nobody cared who the president, the IMB or the ERLC was. If the convention was just a group of churches who got together and did nothing other than give money for people to go die in foreign countries while sharing the gospel and do something very similar with seminary, there'd be no need of reform. But because there's so much money and fame involved, it's so bloated and bureaucratic, it attracts all the wrong people. So the way to fund it, or the way to fix it, is just stop funding it, find some like-minded churches, start another seminary. It's easy. You know what you need to start a seminary? A building with a handful of classrooms and then a room. You don't even need a server room now because you can keep stuff on the cloud. You need a room full of computers and some classrooms. I don't know, 10 guys to teach. If you guys have ever been to a Southern Baptist seminary, like if you ever gone to New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, the whole seminary is basically the Hardin Student Center. It's one building. It's like the size of a junior college building. There are some other older buildings where classrooms are. There's a chapel with a, you know, $100,000 pipe organ. There's a music school and another organ in there. And who's using these organs now? People use electronic, you know, people use a keyboard now to make any sound you want that costs $100,000. But a lot of it's housing and the cafeteria to support it. You can make a strip mall seminary. What's that? It's the seminary where Owen Strahan works. They call it a strip mall seminary. Guys, you can get together and make a strip mall seminary easy. I went to seminary online and at Johnson Ferry Baptist Church. On their third floor, they have classrooms. They let the seminary use them. That's what I did. You don't need much space to make a seminary. You can do that easy. It doesn't have to be 100 years old. It doesn't have to have giant buildings and steeps. They don't even have to have a library. Guys, I went to the library. I should say twice. My hermeneutics teacher made us go to the library during a workshop week. on campus and get some books. It was very nice. He explained to us how to research and stuff. And then I went to the North Georgia Library because I had a classroom. I had a class that met there because they're out of space. We met on in the library. It was a video class. It was logic. I checked out a book, but just for my own personal reading. I used internet resources. So much is on the internet. And just books that I get on Kindle. I just get Kindle to cite my papers. I needed very little from the seminary infrastructure. So, Jeff, to get to the glory days would be to create a seminary which basically just had a mission board to send out missionaries. No conferences. The conferences make money. Nope. Nobody to promote books. I'm talking, hey, no Sunday school board. Nope. No Sunday. The seminary teaches people how to make their own Sunday school literature. So no bookshop. The seminary could have an academic press. So this is what I would have at a minimum. A seminary with an academic press, which was outsourced because you don't need to own your own facilities. I print my books on Amazon whenever I want them. So a seminary with an academic press, not the actual hardware to do the press, but just a publishing arm for the seminary for academic books, nothing else. And a mission board to fund missionaries. No lobbyists. No marketers. Nothing. Something that was so austere that nobody would want to go try to sell to it. Even the convention itself is a moneymaker because vendors want to get booths to sell you software and church resources and this, that, and the other. All this junk. I've heard the convention described as full of carnival barkers trying to walk to the convention hall. All these people trying to sell stuff to you. And finally, theology. Theology at base. The theology they had in 1845 is not the quote-unquote Hobbes-Rogers traditionalism we have now. The church growth movement hit. So now people see success as growing numbers. That's getting decisions. That's Phineas aisle walking. But it's really not about saving souls. It's about your resume. If churches weren't trying to poach vision casters from other churches, nobody would care if you baptized 100 people and the church on the other side of the county baptized 50 and say, oh, we got to get that guy for our pastor. KRAs. Remember the KRAs I talked about? If there were no KRAs. What's the theology of KRAs? Holy Spirit's going to do what the Holy Spirit's going to do. Just do the Great Commission. He'll figure out. He's already figured out. He already knows. God did it before the foundation of the world. How many people are going to get saved and baptized? He knows. You're just carrying out a plan that God's already set up to execute it. Not building your own plans and executions in the name of church growth. You think all these aisle walkers getting wet in Fog Machine Baptist Church? FBC, you thought it meant First Baptist Church. It means Fog Machine Baptist Church. At Fog Machine Baptist Church, you think all those people getting wet in the baptistry at Fog Machine Baptist Church singing Hillsong to a laser light show? Do you think those people are actually saved? Do you think those people are sealed to the day of redemption? Do you think God has good works for them? No. The convention's full of a bunch of unregenerate and apathetic people, Jeff. That's why it's so wrong. That's why wicked men lead it, because it's full of wicked people. So it is irredeemable. And the kind of protections in place that need to be is just bare minimum funding to do the job. A convention that can't enrich anyone. Well, there's no career jumping. Sorry, academics. You're a professor, and then you got a dean, and that's it. And that guy makes like $10,000 more. I don't know. So, Jess, that's the answer to my question. And you know what? I'm dangerously close to my house. So I'm gonna talk about one abortion argument. Awful abortion arguments. I'm gonna reset it. I was gonna talk about several, but I'm out of time. I'm gonna talk about breath of life. So here's an awful abortion argument you'll get from non-believers, or even somebody who's a nominal believer, like a mainliner. They'll say, "You say life begins at conception." I'm like, "Yes, that's science. There's the embryo. The separate person cannot begin to exist anytime before conception, and it's arbitrary to define the life as existing scientifically, I would say, anytime after. So a unique person, how about this, living being is created at conception. That's when life begins, and since that person is made in the image of God, don't abort them. That simple. And they'll say, "Well, the Bible teaches that life doesn't begin until you breathe." What? Well, life doesn't begin until you breathe, and you don't breathe on your own until you're born. Has anybody ever wondered how babies breathe? I actually looked this up. I wonder. Because you ever see a pregnant woman swimming, and you're like, "The pregnant woman's swimming. Why didn't the baby drown?" Or the pregnant woman, her water breaks, and you say, "Wait a minute. The baby's been enveloped in fluid this whole time? How's he breathe?" Well, the baby breathes through the umbilical cord. Oxygen, well, he didn't really breathe. Let me back that up. So the umbilical cord is what provides nutrients and oxygen to the baby. So a baby is born, and his lungs are developed. He's outside of the womb. He's not basically underwater anymore. He can breathe on his own, so you cut the umbilical cord, hand him to the mom, and he starts breastfeeding immediately. So, fact, babies don't start breathing until after they're born. So you get all these heartbeat bills, right? People say, "Oh, there's a heartbeat. There's a beating heart. Abortion stops a beating heart." That's a winner. You talk about pro-life slogans. You talk about putting moms in jail as a murder moms in jail as a loser, like I talked about last time. A winner is abortion stops a beating heart. That's a winner. But people will say, "No, it's not until breath, and the embryo is not breathing. You're not breathing until you're born." And they'll say, "That's what the ancient Jews taught, that life began at breath." And here it is. They go to Genesis and they say, "God made Adam from the dust of the ground." Let me hit the pause button. You don't believe in Genesis. You don't believe in that story at all. You believe in evolution, not that God just made some dude out of the ground and then made his wife from his rib. You don't believe that the human race just was created by God, fully formed, on the sixth day. No one who ever quotes that to me actually believes it. And they'll say, "But this is what the ancient Jews believed." I'm sorry, do the ancient Jews have a sonogram? I don't know if they believe that or not. They read this on the internet. I read this on the internet yesterday, let me tell you. And the Bible says that God breathed into the man and he became a living being. So you're not technically alive until you breathe, and that's the biblical standard. And to that I say, can you find me the embryo that God made out of dirt? Because these new embryos are all made out of people. So here's what's going on with Adam. By the way, you can look this up in the scriptures, in the Hebrew word. I think the word is, you'd think, since I was going to do my show about it, that I would have looked up the word before I left. I think it's ruach. You got to get the spit in your mouth for the Hebrew. Ruach. I don't know if that's it. It's the word for breath. This breath, air, spirit. It's the same word. Just like pneuma. We get our English word pneumatic for, like, if you have a pneumatic device, it's air powered. But in the Greek, pneuma is the Greek word for air. It's also the Greek word for spirit. Why? I don't know, because you can't see a spirit, but it's there. So when God breathed life into Adam, and he became a living being. It's he got a spirit. It's not talking about his physiological ability to breathe. I don't know how much the ancients knew about what the umbilical cord did and the breathing and whatnot. But that's not the way we're talking about hermeneutics. This is seminary learning. Not that I was taught this in seminary. I was taught hermeneutics in seminary. And when somebody says this to me and I say, that's stupid, let me do a proper hermeneutic. So God formed man out of the dust of the ground. So he was inanimate. He was inanimate, formed from dirt. So non-living material, and God made him living by giving him breath, spirit. See, God is spirit, and man is made in what? The image of God. What's that mean? We're spiritual too. We have a body and a spirit. What made us a living being? Not just the body, a human being, because animals have bodies but not spirits, is that we have breath from God. Our breath is from God. My dogs breathe, but they're not made in the image of God. Our breath is from God, our humans. Human breath is for God. God breathed life into it, and that we're spiritual beings. That's what that means. It's not a standard of, well, the biblical says you're not alive until you breathe. Because Adam wasn't alive until he breathed. He breathed. So therefore, babies aren't alive until they breathe. All right. Okay. Adam wasn't born either. He was made from dirt. So if you find a person made of dirt who doesn't have the breath of God in him, let, by all means, you can throw that dirt person off a bridge if you want to. But if you're talking about a baby made in the image of God who's made by mommy and daddy, don't kill him because you misapplied the Bible. Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute. Lord willing, I'll be back with you again tomorrow. As always, God bless. And as always, remember, Christianity is not about getting saved. It's about being saved.
Thanks for listening to the Christian Commute. Please send your questions about Christian apologetics and theology to sethdunn88@gmail.com. If you are not a Christian, please remember that you can be reconciled to God through the shed blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. The Bible teaches that all who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. Repent of your sins now and accept Jesus as Lord. God bless.